OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom, and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Matot Maseh. We bench Rosh Chodesh of this Shabbat. Today, recording and first broadcast is Thursday, Yom Chamishi B'Shabbat, the 26th of Tammuz, 5767, on the secular calendar, July 12th. Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli, Tihyena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Imavonot Tishmoriah Adonai Mia Amod. Ki Imacha Haslicha L'Ma'an Tivarei. Kiviti Adonai Kivata Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi L'Adonai Mishomerim L'Boker Shomerim L'Boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut, v'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya, ha-omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha-makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha u'meafela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. On the topic of benching Rosh Chodesh in general, let me remind listeners that it is the custom on the Shabbat before the first of a Jewish month to announce the coming month. It is accompanied by a prayer for a good month. And there was some notion in the past, I don't know exactly where and when, that perhaps we should not announce the coming of Rosh Chodesh Av, because the Mishnah says, Misha nichnas Av mima'atim b'simcha, when Av enters, we diminish our joy. It is a month that, because of Tisha B'Av, has a sad cloud over it, shall we say, even though the 15th of Av is a very festive day in Jewish literature. Yet apparently some communities followed that custom of not benching Rosh Chodesh, not announcing Rosh Chodesh Av, based on a verse in the book of Iov, Job, which indicated that Av shall not be considered or counted among the months of the year. That's a wishful thinking kind of thing, not an actual suggestion, because then we would have trouble with the calendar. Be that as it may, I love using that expression when it fits, be that as it may, the overwhelming practice is certainly to announce the coming of every month except for Tishrei, which has a different reason. And the Rosh Chodesh Av specifically, if we realize that the announcement of Rosh Chodesh is accompanied by a blessing of the month, then what month can use our blessing more than the month of Av? As far as the name of the month is concerned, the custom is for this Shabbat to announce Rosh Chodesh Menachem Av, the comforting month of Av, will be on Yom Sheni, Monday. But there is also a custom, and this is not as widespread, and I'm sure there are different practices, but the one that I'm most familiar with, and the one that I sense has a ring of truth to it and a message to it, is that aside from the announcement that Rosh Chodesh Menachem Av is coming, On the first 10 days of the month, we refer to the month as Av. There is Bet Av, Gimel Av, the third of the month of Av, etc., etc. Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av. The mournful practices of the 9 days continue through the 10th day until noontime. And after that, the element of Nechama, comfort, takes over, or should take over, and we modify the name of the month, and we call it Menachem Av. All of this means nothing if we don't feel the flavors that these names connote. In other words, there's a certain starkness to the beginning part of the month, and the name Av, a brief one-syllable name, seems to fit. And then, after Tisha B'Av, and it really starts on Tisha B'Av itself, when we introduce the element of Nechama with the addition to the bracha in the Amidah called Nachem, that we have the feel of that light at the end of the tunnel, the capping off of the sorrow that is associated with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, with the realization, with the prayers, that there come a time soon in our own lifetimes that the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt, and we will be privileged to rejoice in that rebuilding. And that comfort takes over the flavor of the month, so that the name change sort of brings that fuller feeling of Menachem Av. Let's now take an overview of Parshiot Matot Maaseh. It's a double sedra. Combined, they form the longest of the Torah readings of Shabbat, 244 verses, several different topics to speak about. The first one is the topic of vows, pledges, promises, oaths, etc., and plain giving one's word. The Torah starts by telling us that if a person makes a promise, a pledge, takes a vow, or whatever, or swears something, then he shall not profane his word, lo yachel divaro, but rather kechol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh, what comes out of his mouth he should do. If we were to stop here, we would get the notion which some cultures have, and Judaism does not or is not supposed to, that whatever a person says he has to do, even if it's ridiculous, counterproductive, not what he meant, etc., etc., because the naked wording in the Torah is, lo yachel devaro, he shall not profane his word, kechol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh, whatever comes out of his mouth, he shall do. However, the Torah continues, and it's important to take the continuation in the context of this first harsh, stark statement. It speaks of a woman who takes a pledge or a vow, makes a promise, a young woman, a 12-year-old girl, and technically it's between 12 and 12 and a half, that we attribute to the character of Na'ara, to a girl, and if she is to take some kind of promise during that period, and her father hears about it, he has the authority of the Torah, as clearly stated in this passage, to nullify that pledge. An adult woman makes a pledge, she's expected to keep it. A na'ara, a child, we don't say is bound to their promises and pledges, because they really don't understand the significance of making that kind of commitment. But right in between, a 12 to 12 and a half year old girl, a na'ara, has the presence of mind to understand the significance of a pledge, yet she does not have the full maturity, and her father, on the day that he hears of this promise, pledge, vow, has the authority to nullify it. That process is called Hafarat Nidarim. Similarly, but with differences, the Torah describes a wife's vow that on the day that her husband hears of the vow, he has the authority to proclaim the vow null and void, and that is also Hafarat Nidarim, and the woman is not bound to keep that pledge. The commentaries and the Talmud really teach us that in the case of a husband, the wife's vow has to directly impact on him for him to have the authority to nullify it on the day that he hears it. But these are the two examples that the Torah presents in writing to already soften the kechol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh, whatever comes out of his mouth he shall do, with the exception of hafarat nidarim by a father of a na'ara, by a husband of his wife. Then we have another Torah concept, not from the text of the Torah, but from our oral law, where we are taught, this is part of the laws of Nidarim, the laws of pledges and promises, and that is the concept called Hatarat Nidarim, release from vows. The sort of connection to the wording in the verse, although it doesn't need to be connected, it's enough that we have a tradition in the oral law that this exists, but the connection is, Lo yachel devaro, the person who made the pledge shall not profane his words, but others have the authority to do that under certain circumstances. Let's give a little view of Hatarat Nidarim, because it is much more common in our experience than Hafarat Nidarim, even though it's Hafarat Nidarim that is spelled out in the wording of the Torah, and Hatarat Nidarim is a Talmudic presentation of a Torah law. A person makes a vow. I'll use one of my favorite examples, and now I could say it with a little bit more confidence than I used to say it, for reasons that are known to me and to people who know me. Example, a person gets on his scale, is not happy that he's putting on weight, and he attributes his downfall to chocolate chip cookies, and he makes a solemn vow not to eat chocolate chip cookies. Couple of months go by, the person has dieted and exercised properly in addition to keeping his vow and not eating chocolate chip cookies, and he has dropped weight, and his weight is now at or even a little below where he would have liked to be. He goes to a party, and the hostess brings out a tray of freshly baked, still warm chocolate chip cookies, his all-time favorite. And he really does not need to stay away from them. Oh, you want to get technical about it? These were made with whole wheat flour and with a natural sugar substitute, etc., etc. Anyway, he is not allowed to eat chocolate chip cookies. He made a vow not to. But he has permission of the Torah to approach a rabbi who is an expert on the laws of promises and vows, or a panel of three fellow Jews who constitute a Beit Din, a mini court, and say before them, I made a vow a number of months ago. I did not realize the ramifications of that vow. Had I realized that I would drop my weight to a respectable number, and that I would once again be able to handle eating chocolate chip cookies, which I very much enjoy, and I'm only going to have one, etc., etc. Had I realized this at the time that I took the vow, I never would have set it as a vow. I would have put a proviso in until I reach a certain weight, or I would have said Beli Neder, that I'm not committing myself in the form of a pledge, because a form of a pledge is a very serious thing. Let me just shift the scenario for a moment. If 2 days after the guy made the pledge not to eat chocolate chip cookies, he happens to eat one at a party by accident, meaning he wasn't thinking, he just reached onto the plate, made his bracha, ate the chocolate chip cookie, and realized that he violated his vow, then what he did was a forbidden act as serious as eating pork. Sounds really weird to say that, because pork is not kosher and chocolate chip cookies are, but not to him. The person who vowed not to eat chocolate chip cookies is forbidden to eat chocolate chip cookies, like he is forbidden to eat pork. And he created that prohibition, which makes it a little worse, because he didn't have to do that in the first place. But I digress. Hatarat Nedarim, you present to the panel or to the expert Rav, and you say, had I realized X, Y, or Z at the time that I was making this vow, I never would have made it, or I would have made it and sounded it differently. On that basis, which is known as a petach ledavar, it's an opening by which to say that the words of the oath did not actually match the feelings that the person had, that he was too hasty in making that vow, then the court has the authority to release the person from that vow. When we say a formula Hatarat Nedarim, Rosh Hashanah time, or right before Yom Kippur, we say in there that I'm not asking to have a vow nullified that shouldn't be nullified, that's not allowed to be nullified. I only want to nullify those vows of things that I said that I can't even remember, commitments that I made in a language that's akin to taking a pledge that I forgot about, and or things that I don't want in the form of that kind of commitment, even if it's a good thing. Person who says Tehillim every day or learns Mishnayot every day and made it into a pledge even without verbalizing it, but just by virtue of the fact that he did it day after day after day and wants to get out of it, not to stop doing the good deed, not to stop learning the Mishnah or to stop giving tzedakah or whatever, but just that it shouldn't be with this extra weight over one's head in the form of a pledge, has a basis on which to say Hatarat Nedarim and have his vow released. This puts a very, very different flavor and feeling to the concept of Nedarim from the original stark Lo Yachel Devaro, you shall not profane your word, and Kechol Hayotze Mipiv Ya'aseh, whatever comes out of your mouth, you shall do. Enough said on this topic. Before we begin another one, let's listen to some a cappella music, meaning vocal only, of the nature that would be permissible during the 3 weeks, the song Rachem.
Oh,
Come from the Zmirot of Friday night, specifically Tzur Mishalo, third stanza, Rachem Bechazdecha, have mercy in your kindness, Al Amcha, on your nation, Tzureinu, our rock. Those are the words of the song. The stanza itself from Tzur Mishalo continues that it is on the Beit HaMikdash that we ask you to have mercy and rebuild it, that you should hasten the coming of the Mashiach. Certainly an appropriate prayer to God at this time when we mourn the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, Sheyibaneh b'mheira v'yameinu. May it be rebuilt speedily in our time. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio on either OU Radio or on Israel National Radio. One way or the other, this show is for Matot Maseh. We spoke about the topic of Nidarim. Let's move on. The Torah tells us about the battle against Midian, the one that was mentioned in last week's Torah reading. Here's when it took place. It was successful. Spoils of war were brought back by the soldiers. They were divided between themselves and the people. Various taxes were taken. And there's a lot of text about that. We won't go into it now. At this point, it is the tribes of Reuven and Gad who had a lot of livestock. And they came to Moshe and to Elazar HaKohen and to the leaders of the tribes, and they said, the cities that we have captured in this area here, we're talking about the east side of the Jordan River, seem to be very fertile as far as grazing for our sheep, and we would like to be able to settle here, rather than go across the Jordan into the land of Canaan. Moshe's first reaction is anger. He sees and he shudders at the deja vu, so to speak, of the Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies. He sees this as something that might discourage Jews from wanting to continue across the Jordan into Eretz Yisrael, and he's very upset with them. But as it turns out, he, at God's instructions, imposes an oath upon the tribes of Reuven and Gad, later joined by half of Menasheh, the 2.5 tribes as they are known, an oath that they would settle their families and their possessions and their flocks, and they would cross the Jordan with their brothers during the period of conquest of Eretz Yisrael, and only after successful conquest would they return to their new home. And this is acceptable all around, and it becomes a fact on the ground. At the beginning of Parshat Maseh, we find the travelogue of the people of Israel from the moment they left Egypt, the names of the places at which they camped during their 40-year wandering period. When the record of the travels is completed, we find ourselves once again in Arvot Moav, the plains of Moav, opposite Jericho, Jericho, on the other side of the Jordan River. And God says to Moshe, at that place, Arvot Moav al Yarden Yericho, saying, speak to the people of Israel and tell them that they will be soon crossing the Jordan into Eretz Canaan, and they will conquer it from the nations that live there. And v'horashtem et ha'aretz v'shavtem bah, they will acquire the land, parenthetically, as promised to them through their ancestors, Vishavtem ba, and they shall dwell there. Says Ramban Nachmanides, this is the verse that teaches us the mitzvah called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvah to live in Israel. Well, if that doesn't sound like a mitzvah for Arut Sheva, and that doesn't sound like a mitzvah for Torah Tidbits Audio, I don't know what is. It's not like I've never spoken about the topic before, but let's take a look. Ramban says one of the 613 mitzvot in the Torah is to acquire the land and live in it. Kilachem notati et haaretz l'reshet ota. Because I gave you that land. I give you this land, says God, in order to settle in it. You shall settle in it according to the divine lottery, based on the allocation of the tribes and the people who enter Israel, based on those who left Egypt, etc., etc. In short, this is one of the sources, but the source that Ramban points to, of the mitzvah to live in Israel. Ramban says further that it is a mitzvah in all times for Jewish people to live in Israel, all over Israel, not to leave any part of Eretz Yisrael, not to leave any part of the land of Israel in the hands of other nations, nor to leave any part of Israel desolate. It is a mitzvah to live in Israel, not just its cities, but its way out places as well, so that the entire land should be inhabited by the people that God intended to inhabit the land. Furthermore, it is said that based on this Ramban, a person who lives elsewhere, not in Eretz Yisrael, and makes the place that he lives his home, in other words, does not say, does not feel, well, I know that I should live in Eretz Yisrael, and I hope to someday be able to do it, and I've already made inquiries with Nefesh B'Nefesh, or I already spoke to a shaliach for Aliyah, and I already made pilot trips, and I visit Israel, and I'm thinking of retiring there, or I'm thinking of moving there, or I'm encouraging my children. Not that. We're talking about a person who lives in a community outside of Israel, who psychologically has made that community his home. According to the Ramban, he is in violation of V'horashtem et ha'aretz v'shavtem ba, because the Torah says, Ki lachem notati et ha'aretz, I gave you this land. I didn't give you that land to settle. I gave you those other lands to be exiled into, and to do the best you can in those lands, but not that it should be your heritage and your inheritance and the place where you call home. To be a stranger in a strange land is a very important concept. When that is lost, when Jews say, we have everything we need in, fill in the blank as you see fit, in order to live a complete Jewish life, then I believe they are in non-fulfillment of this mitzvah of V'horashtem et ha'aretz v'shavtem bo. I am not talking about people who are not living in Israel because of a livelihood issue, because of a family kind of issue. Person tells me that he has an elderly mother who can't come now to live in Israel. She's established in whatever community she is. He can't go away from her because it would put too much of a burden on her care and keeping an eye out for her on his sister, let's say. I believe the person has a valid excuse not to come on Aliyah. But I believe that that person should long to come to Eretz Yisrael, pine away for it. I don't mean shrivel up into inactivity and atrophy his mind. I'm talking about a healthy, my heart is in Israel. I don't mean it with lip service, I mean actual. The people who have various and sundry reasons for not coming in Aliyah, those reasons are either good or they're less good, but they are at least reasons. They imply that the person means, believes, and understands that he really should be here. But he can't. Fine. Work towards it. Maybe you'll see that it's more and more possible. I am talking about the people who have removed living in Eretz Yisrael from their agenda, or who never had it on their agenda in the first place. And as far as their Jewishness is concerned, they work hard at keeping Shabbat. They work hard and spend good money on keeping kosher. They work hard on building their sukkah and on building their shuls for davening and all other good kind of things, but somehow Eretz Yisrael is not part of their picture. That person, I believe, is in non-fulfillment of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvah based on the pasuk, V'horashtem et ha'aretz v'yishavtem bah. Now let's pursue this topic a little further. The two favorite responses when presenting someone with Ramban's mitzvah number 4, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, is, hey, Rambam, Maimonides, and Sefer HaChinuch, which also have lists of 613 mitzvot, do not include living in Eretz Yisrael among the number 613. So what do you mean it's a mitzvah? Not everybody says it's a mitzvah. To that I answer, let's take a look at what the Rambam Maimonides does say about living in Eretz Yisrael. He says, and he didn't make it up, he's quoting the Talmud, the Gemara, he says a person should always live in Eretz Yisrael, even in a city, the majority of whose inhabitants are idol worshippers, rather than live, or he says it, and not live, in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, even in a city, the majority of whose inhabitants are Jewish. He goes on in describing the virtues of living in Eretz Yisrael and the mitzvot that can be fulfilled here and only here, but let's not belabor that aspect of it. It is clear that the Rambam considers it also a great mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, an imperative for a Jew to live in Eretz Yisrael. The fact that he didn't is lamented by him, and I can't really explain it more than that. The fact that the Ramban in his last years made it to Eretz Yisrael and settled here speaks for him, but that's besides the point. The point is, Le'olam Yodur Adam Be'eretz Yisrael. A person, a Jew, should always strive to live in Israel. It doesn't say strive, it says he should live in Israel. What about all the Jews that don't? Again, I want to categorize them in the ones who say, of course I accept that a person should live in Eretz Yisrael, but it's not so simple. I understand that very, very well. I understand that there are also plenty of Jews who made it to Israel, who came by choice to be in Eretz Yisrael to fulfill their dream, and it's really more than that, because it's actually to fulfill a great mitzvah in the Torah. It's a mitzvah that not only is one of the mitzvot of the Torah, it is a mitzvah that puts you into an environment which is the natural intended environment for a life of Torah. I've said this many, many times. But we don't even have to go in that direction. Obviously, it's not an easy thing. It's much, much easier to go out and buy a pair of tefillin or tzitzis or to keep Shabbos or actually to do anything. I would say living in Eretz Yisrael, if you don't live here, and making the move is about as major an attempt at fulfilling mitzvot as anything. I mean, hand shmura matzah for the Seder, what does it cost? 120 shekel a kilo. and however much you buy, you know, and counting the Omer is much less of a commitment. I don't know. I don't even want to start actually going through the list and see what mitzvah is harder than this. It's hard to do mitzvot in general, and this one is certainly hard, and I'm not arguing on that basis. I'm not arguing, and I'm not saying things to make a person who doesn't live here feel bad, and he has to avert his eyes when I'm talking to him, and he has to say, well, what am I supposed to do? It's just not working out, or I can't do that. I'm not arguing that. I am arguing against the people who say, why should I even consider Aliyah? These are the people that vacation other places around the world. These are the people that buy and remodel expensive homes in different communities and work hard at the Jewish infrastructure of their community. And I'm not taking that away. I'm just saying that that effort and that energy would be perhaps better spent on building a home in Eretz Yisrael and living here and help build a community here. Because this is where God wants us to be. When he kicked us out of Eretz Yisrael and exiled us and we were carried in chains to Babylonia, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about today when making Aliyah is almost a phone call away and is easier and easier and easier as time goes on. We joke here in Israel about the before Nefesh B'Nefesh days and the since Nefesh B'Nefesh days, how more difficult it was when you had to make a trip down to the Ministry of the Interior to process your papers and the Ministry of Education and the municipality for kindergartens and things like that. And many of these bureaucratic tasks are now facilitated by Nefesh B'Nefesh. So there's almost a before and an after. There's Aliyah before cell phones and Aliyah since cell phones. I remember the old days when people would say, oh, I didn't have a phone line for 6 months. I ordered it and there was this kind of mess up and this kind of snafu and everything was, you know. And today, you come with a cell phone, so you don't even need a phone line in your house if you don't want one. And certainly you could do with a cell phone until you get one. Etc., etc. My latest on the list is baseball. With the inaugural season of Israel Baseball League, and hopefully it'll be successful and continue, we half seriously and half jokingly say now that the last excuse for not coming to live in Israel is gone. Last Sunday afternoon, I had the pleasure. It's more than that, but I don't want to belabor the adjectives there and the nouns. I had the pleasure of taking my grandson, 7-year-old Devir, to his first baseball game. It's something that when I came on Aliyah, my children were younger than he is now, and I was not thinking in terms of taking children or grandchildren to baseball games. But it was a realization of one of the things you left behind. And now I was able to bring my grandson to a baseball game, and Amir Tzashem, there'll be more. And I taught him the rudiments of the game, and every pitch, whether it was a ball, a strike, or a foul, or a hit, or an out, he would tug me on the sleeve and say, is that good for our team, or is that bad for our team? Because he wanted to get into rooting, but he wasn't sure that he should say yay when... Anyway, I won't go into that more. The point. I often used to say, and still do, mitzvah aspect aside, this is obviously where God wants the Jewish people to be. When he spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu at the burning bush, he said, I am going into Egypt to take the people out and bring them to the land of Canaan, a land flowing of milk and honey. That was the purpose of it. It's repeated in prophecies, and it pervades, especially the book of Devarim, which we're on the threshold of now. But that's one aspect. Mitzvah, pure commandment. And here comes a second favorite objection of people that I speak to. Well, I heard that Rav Moshe Feinstein or this other rabbi said that the mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah kiyumit, not a mitzvah chiyuvit. What that means is, and this is one opinion, that there are two types of commandments. There are obligatory commandments, meaning if you do them, you are fulfilling a mitzvah. If you don't, you are in violation, because these are obligations. A person can't say, I don't like the taste of matzah, or it's too expensive, or it tastes like cardboard, or whatever, so I will forego the mitzvah of matzah on the first night of Pesach. He can't say that. It's an obligation. Every Jewish man, woman, and child has to eat a certain portion of matzah. But, just to keep it in the same example, matzah on the third day of Pesach is optional. According to many opinions, it's the fulfillment of a mitzvah, as it says in the Torah, and you shall eat matzah 7 days, but it is not chiyuvit. If a person says, too much matzah, it's too fattening and I'd rather cut down, he has the right to do that. And if he doesn't eat matzah, he's not in violation when it's during Pesach, except for the first night. That would be a thumbnail description of the difference between chiyuvit and kiyumit. Kiyumit means you fulfilled it, but there's no obligation in that sense. So, people want to suggest that we're dealing with a mitzvah that is not obligatory, although there are others who say, what are you talking about? Of course it's obligatory. And that would be the Ramban's approach. And it seems to be the Rambam's approach, and it seems to be what the Gemara is saying. But to pick yourself up and come here is definitely a mitzvah. Perhaps you're not in violation for not doing it. I turn back to these people, fine, sincere, Torah-observant Jews, and say, tell me, is that your attitude about any other mitzvah? There are other mitzvot, which are mitzvot kiyumiyot, meaning a mitzvah to fulfill, and you go out of your way to do it, even though technically you have no obligation. So don't give me this reason. That's why you don't come in Aliyah. This, for fear of saying it again, this is where God wants us to be. This is where Torah was meant to be observed. I must add, Torah can be observed anywhere in the world, and that's important. The Torah was given at Sinai, not in Eretz Yisrael, to make sure that Jews, even when they are outside of Eretz Yisrael, even when they are in exile, know that they have to keep the Torah. But the natural venue of Torah was Eretz Yisrael, is Eretz Yisrael. And we're not here yet. We're in physical Eretz Yisrael, and we've got a long way to go till it becomes that full spiritual entity that it was meant to be. But at least we're in that direction. At least we're part of the way there. Well, I'm not surprised that time is almost out for this issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, and we didn't get to a few other topics I wanted to mention in Mas'eh, and we didn't get to another a cappella song, which hopefully I'll play for you next week, Imir Tzashem, but I knew it would happen. I'm not at all surprised, because I sort of get animated on this topic. And it's not because I live here. I live here because of the animation of this topic. It is a wonderful thing to take a deep breath here in Israel and fill your lungs with air of Eretz Yisrael at every breath. The same air that somebody had the cute notion of canning so that people could take a can of Eretz Yisrael air back with them. I have a much better idea. Forget the canned air. Come here and breathe it. Breath after breath. There's nothing better. Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameach.